In Augusta, Georgia, White House correspondents were summoned to an extraordinary news conference in the Richmond Hotel. Most expected the oft-predicted announcement about Secretary Dulles' resignation. None anticipated the drama in the president's demeanor as he faced the cameras.
I had a conversation this morning with him, and in view of the findings that doctors have made yesterday, and which were not yet reported when I met him day before yesterday, he has definitely made up his mind to submit his resignation. The formal letter of resignation will reach me in a day or so. I will then reply to it. I want to make one or two things clear. The findings are not of the kind, so far as I am aware, that make him helpless. He is, nevertheless, absolutely incapacitated so far as carrying on the administrative burdens of the office, as well as doing the thinking for it over there. So I'm saying he's incapacitated for carrying on the administrative load, as well as in addition to assisting in the making of policy. So I have asked him to remain as my consultant, and I will appoint him to some office that makes it possible for him to be useful both to the State Department and to me, because I think all of you know my opinion of Secretary Dulles. I personally believe he has filled his office with greater distinction and greater ability than any other man our country has known. He's a man of tremendous character and courage, intelligence and wisdom. And therefore, my determination to keep him close where he can be useful, both to the State Department and to me, and indeed in considering everything that may affect our foreign relations, I think is a very wise and proper thing to do. I can't tell you how much regret I feel about this. And I'm quite sure that the United States will share that feeling. Goodbye. Thank you.
Later on, the president notified the reporters he had not intended to use the word absolutely when he spoke of Mr. Dulles as being incapacitated, and asked that the word absolutely be deleted from transcripts of his remarks. A view of Washington's reaction and some possibilities for the near and longer range future now from CBS News Washington correspondent Howard K. Smith.
If Mr. Dulles had critics in this city, and some claim to recall that he did, they have sunk without trace in a universal surge of sympathy and praise for him here today. Fellow Republicans tend to accept the judgment made by ex-President Hoover today, who said that Dulles was possibly our greatest Secretary of State. Those who differed with Mr. Dulles on policies concede that it is not only what a public servant does, but how he does it that matters. And in that respect, they say, Mr. Dulles guided the nation's foreign relations for six trying years in an unusually masterful and respect-inspiring manner. The questions that arise now are, who will replace him, and will that mean a change in policy? The answer most insistently heard to that first question is, Mr. Herter will still be the most likely Secretary of State to follow. Some say that the president's failure to name him today may have been due to a wish to advise some senators from both parties beforehand in order to win congressional support for Mr. Dulles' successor. As to a change of policy, some degree of that is now thought to be possible. The forces making for a reconsideration of long-fixed positions were at work on Mr. Dulles, and he had begun yielding to some of them when sickness laid him low. A less steel-willed successor might yield somewhat more readily to those pressures for change. This is thought to be the more likely because Mr. Dulles's exit happens as the rigid Adenauer is taking a cut in influence within the Western Alliance, and the flexible Macmillan is playing a more active role. Back now to Douglas Edwards in New York.
Throughout the Western world tonight, a unanimous chorus of sympathy and sorrow tinged somewhat with concern for the future. From Radio Moscow, a report of the Dulles news, but no immediate comment.
In just a moment, we'll bring you Edward R. Murrow with the news.
This is the news. President Eisenhower today announced the resignation of John Foster Dulles as Secretary of State. He made the announcement at his vacation headquarters in Augusta, Georgia, after conferring with Mr. Dulles for 4 or 5 minutes on the telephone. The president emphasized that the decision to resign because of recurring cancer had been made by Mr. Dulles himself. Only yesterday, doctors at Walter Reed Hospital expressed fear that the cancer had spread to the cervical vertebrae, that is, to the lower neck. Mr. Eisenhower said he wanted to make it clear that although Dulles was incapacitated for carrying the administrative load as Secretary of State along with formulating policy, he was not helpless, and he would continue to serve as a consultant in the field of foreign affairs. The president praised Mr. Dulles as a man of tremendous character and courage, intelligence, and wisdom. He personally believed that Dulles had filled the office with greater distinction than any other man our country has known. Mr. Eisenhower spoke with deep emotion, and his eyes were wet. He did not name a successor, but the appointment he promised would not be long delayed. It would be a matter of days. A reporter wondered if this meant that Dulles would not be succeeded by Undersecretary of State Christian Herter, as had been generally supposed. Mr. Eisenhower said that there were a number of men with particular talent in this field, and that there were all kinds of considerations to be taken into account. He did not, he said, want to imply either an intention to appoint a particular person or a refusal to do so. He said that, in any event, Mr. Herter would represent the United States at both the meeting of Western foreign ministers in Paris 2 weeks from now and at the foreign ministers' conference with Russia in May. Mr. Eisenhower said that before making a final decision, he would confer with Dulles. News Secretary Hagerty says that Mr. Eisenhower probably will also consult Vice President Nixon. Herter is still believed to be the most likely successor to Dulles. Members of Congress have issued statements praising Mr. Dulles' courage and dedication to duty. Senate Democratic Leader Lyndon Johnson said that Dulles had faced up to difficult and trying tasks with fortitude and resolution. The Republican leader, Senator Dirksen, spoke of Mr. Dulles' dedicated and unselfish service rendered in the conduct of foreign relations and in pursuing the goal of peace and goodwill. Adlai Stevenson said he knew of no one who has served his country more diligently and devotedly than Secretary Dulles. Stevenson said that Dulles will have the gratitude of free people everywhere. Regret and gratitude also are being expressed in the capitals of Western Europe. But our allies, each in a different way, are asking themselves how the resignation of Secretary Dulles will affect American foreign policy and the forthcoming negotiations with Russia regarding general European security and, in particular, Berlin. For that reaction, we go first to my colleague Charles Collingwood in London.
It isn't that the British hadn't expected Mr. Dulles to have to resign. They had. But now that the resignation is a fact, it has made them reflect again on how much he will be missed in this period of talks with Russia, which are about to begin. It's not only that his skills as a negotiator will be missed, he's always taken the lead at the conference table, but the British, who are beginning to feel increasingly isolated diplomatically in the councils of the West, had come to think, just as he was taken ill, that Mr. Dulles was really on their side, or at least that he understood what they were getting at in their suggestions as to how to deal with the Russians. He, they knew, had it in his power to shift American policy toward a more flexible line and strongly to influence the attitudes of Chancellor Adenauer and General de Gaulle. They do not think that Mr. Dulles' successor, whoever he may be, however able he may be, will have that power, or if he did, would be able to exercise it between now and the Geneva Foreign Ministers meeting next month. The British are therefore more than ever resigned now to fighting a lonely battle for their own more flexible proposals. Commenting on this, the London Evening Standard tonight concludes that the retirement of Mr. Dulles will put new responsibilities on Prime Minister Macmillan. Now, only he, says the Standard, has the will to try out new ideas and the authority to persuade the Western allies to accept a change of policy. Speaking about successors to Mr. Dulles, the British were somewhat surprised that President Eisenhower did not today name Acting Secretary Christian Herter as Mr. Dulles' successor. The comment in England on Mr. Dulles' departure from active diplomacy has been warm and appreciative. Prime Minister Macmillan spoke of his dedication. Foreign Secretary Selwyn Lloyd praised Mr. Dulles' intellectual gifts and sense of duty. The leader of the opposition, Hugh Gaitskell, paid tribute to his profound knowledge of world affairs. A most serious loss to the West, said Mr. Gaitskell. For many years, John Foster Dulles has been the focus of British criticism, both informed and uninformed, of American policy. It is ironic that opinion in Britain, at least, only warmed to him in his last months in office. Now back to Ed Murrow in New York.
The French also are looking ahead to a new chapter in American diplomacy, although they expect the principles of American foreign policy to remain pretty much the same. For that story, we switch to Paris and David Schonbrunn.
There is sadness and even embarrassment here in Paris tonight, but there is no gloom. The resignation of Mr. Dulles did not come as a surprise in this capital of NATO. NATO officials who returned from Washington a week ago all were convinced that the resignation of Mr. Dulles was only a matter of days. Indeed, for the past 2 weeks or so, Western diplomats have been proceeding on the assumption that there would be a change in the personal direction of American foreign policy. But they seem to be convinced that there will be no major change in the principles of that policy. Although Mr. Dulles was the chief architect of America's policy, Mr. Eisenhower was and remains the head of the firm, and it's unlikely that he will permit any radical changes. It is also unlikely, it is thought in Paris, that Mr. Eisenhower would appoint a successor who did not convince him that he subscribes to the basic Dulles views. The key word to describe Dulles' thinking over here is the word views or attitudes, for in fact, there was no Dulles doctrine as such. John Foster Dulles was a lawyer who held deep convictions, but he was not a creative thinker as foreign secretary. He did not introduce any doctrines comparable to the Marshall Plan, to the Atlantic Alliance, or to the European Community, which were the economic, military, and political pillars of American foreign policy before the Dulles era. Mr. Dulles carried on the policies laid down by his predecessors. His own contribution was a style of diplomacy rather than a doctrine. He was the official no-man of the Western world, and as such played a highly important role at a time when there was a good deal of wavering and wondering about new directions, and a no-man was badly needed. We are, however, now entering a whole new period of diplomacy, and the feeling here is that perhaps a new man was needed. This is Paris. David Schonbrunn reporting. I return you now to Edward R. Murrow in New York.
In West Germany, there is a feeling of personal loss. Ernest Leiser reports that story from Bonn.
The government of West Germany almost always takes note with prompt protocol of the death or departure of a foreign statesman. Usually, however, its statements are formal, a bit cold, and cut and dried. They read as if they've been dredged out of a bottom drawer from a file labeled platitude. But it was different in Bonn today when the news reached here that Secretary Dulles had succumbed to his cancer and had to resign. Comment came quickly, but it was not just diplomatic niceties when the West German government said that Dulles' action was a great loss, especially for the German people. Nor was it a platitude when the foreign ministry said that it, in particular, looked back to long years of common effort with Dulles, full of understanding and full of trust. Chancellor Konrad Adenauer, on holiday in Italy, declined to say anything formal for the record right away. But those of us who talked with Adenauer's aides with the old man were told that he seemed really moved and deeply saddened. This is not surprising. Adenauer, despite his granite face, is a moody and emotional man. And for a long while, he has regarded Dulles as much a personal friend as an ally. The Chancellor has let it be known that he has had more faith in the consistency of policy and purpose of the U.S. Secretary of State than he's had in the U.S. President. It is undoubtedly true, as a newspaper here close to Adenauer said today, that the 83-year-old Chancellor regarded Dulles and himself as the two strongest pillars of the West, holding the Atlantic Alliance firm against Soviet attempts to undermine it. But there is also some unhappiness in official Bonn tonight about the fact that since Dulles had to go, he did not lay down his mantle earlier. The West Germans think that just over 3 weeks is not enough time for a new Secretary of State to organize and lead U.S. foreign policy into a big four meeting with Russia. Even if Undersecretary Herder takes over, the Germans say, he cannot emerge from the shadow of his boss in so short a time. This is Ernest Leiser in Bonn. Now back to Edward R. Murrow in New York.
The third incident in 3 weeks was reported today in the Allied air corridor leading to Berlin. An American transport while flying to and from Berlin was tailed for several miles by two Soviet fighter aircraft. But unlike the two previous cases, the transport was not buzzed. In connection with the resignation of Secretary Dulles, there comes to mind these words written by Woodrow Wilson. Wilson was writing of the elder Pitt. His mind was clear and strong. His will was unwavering. His convictions were uncompromising. His confidence in himself was implicit. His love for his country was real and intense. Good night and good luck.
In a few days, President Eisenhower will nominate Christian Herter to be our next Secretary of State. The word comes from a top Republican who prefers to remain anonymous. Herter underwent a physical examination Wednesday by a specially selected doctor. The doctor found that Herter's arthritis will not prevent him from running the State Department. Mr. Eisenhower talked by telephone with John Foster Dulles yesterday, presumably discussing with him the Herter nomination. The president also asked new Secretary Hagerty to release Dulles' formal letter of resignation.
Dear Mr. President, it is apparent to me that I shall not be well enough soon enough to continue to serve as Secretary of State. Accordingly, I tender my resignation to be effective at your convenience. I am deeply grateful for the opportunities and responsibilities you have given me. I was brought up in the belief that this nation of ours was not merely a self-serving society, but was founded with a mission to help build a world where liberty and justice would prevail. Today, that concept faces a formidable and ruthless challenge from international communism. This has made it manifestly difficult to adhere steadfastly to our national idealism and national mission, and at the same time avoid the awful catastrophe of war. You have given inspiring leadership to this essential task, and it has been a deep satisfaction to me to have been intimately associated with you in these matters. If I can, in a more limited capacity, continue to serve, I shall be happy to do so. Signed, faithfully yours, John Foster Dulles.
Then Hagerty read President Eisenhower's formal acceptance of the Dulles resignation. It began, "Dear Foster,
you have been a staunch bulwark of our nation against the machinations of imperialistic communism. You have won to the side of the free world countless peoples and inspired them in renewed courage and determination to fight for freedom and principle. As a statesman of world stature, you have set a record in your stewardship of our foreign relations that stand clear and strong for all to see. By this letter, I request you to serve in the future, to whatever extent your health will permit, as consultant to me and the State Department in international affairs. I know that all Americans join me in the fervent hope that you will thus be able to continue the important contributions that only you can make toward a just peace in the world. With affectionate regard, as ever, D.E.
An exchange of letters at top level. Now for more news, here's Dave.
When Vice President Nixon goes to Moscow in July, he will probably meet with top Soviet officials, possibly with Khrushchev. The president asked Nixon to make the trip yesterday, appointing him as this country's highest representative at the American exhibition in Moscow. This morning, all regular radio and television stations will go off the air for 30 minutes at 11:30 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. They will participate in Operation Alert, which gives the United States Civil Defense Communication System a full-scale test. Some 1,200 Conelrad radio stations will return to the air at 11:30, at 6:40 and 12:40 on your dial to give civil defense bulletins, etc. a good place, a good time to mark the place on your dial where the Conrad stations come in. 640 and 1240 are the frequencies. The time, 37 minutes roughly after the hour.
And here is more news. As far as some people are concerned, Fidel Castro may not be the most welcomed visitor to the United States, but there's no question that the Cuban premier is the most colorful VIP to visit Washington in some time. Reporting now, NBC's Frank McGee in the nation's capital.
Bullets, not ballots, gave Fidel Castro control of the Cuban government, but the bearded rebel chieftain's handshaking, baby-cuddling technique indicates that he could walk away with most any office the voters have to give. He suddenly decided to see the sights around the Cuban embassy late yesterday. Actually, he was the sight as he strolled along, puffing an enormous Havana cigar. High school students visiting from St. Louis crowded around Castro seeking his autograph. Laughing and joking in his halting English, he also answered their questions about his regime. Is it communist, a girl wanted to know. In Cuba, he answered, there is not communist, not capitalist, but Cubanists. Is also politician, first rate. Some reporters were reminded of Vice President Nixon's technique. His stroll through the streets in a nearby park was not scheduled. Castro had complained that cordons of security police are keeping him from meeting and talking with people, necessary if he's to win the friendship he says he wants with this country. Earlier yesterday, he emphasized he was not seeking a loan and said Americans jumped to that conclusion because that was all most foreign governments ever wanted of them. He said he wants understanding of his revolution's aims. Well, this was the sort of conduct that everyone understood. Today, Castro has promised he will answer in full charges that his revolutionary regime is riddled with communists. Frank McGee, NBC News, Washington.
For more than 15 minutes last night, the old, somewhat unsavory-looking Metropolitan Opera House in New York City heard the kind of applause few prima donnas ever hear. On stage, Russia's Bolshoi Ballet, taking curtain call after curtain call. In the audience, more than 3,000 first-nighters, some in mink coats and gowns, some in sweaters and skirts. Some famous movie stars, ambassadors, millionaires, others unknown, interested mainly in seeking or seeing the legendary ballerina Galina Ulanova, who led the Bolshoi troupe in Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet last night. The critics agreed it was a great night at the Metropolitan, where Soviet and American flags hung side by side, and the Cold War seemed far away. Secretary of Defense McElroy has repeated U.S. policy about flying planes in West Berlin. He says we can fly these planes at any altitude, not just under 10,000 feet, as the Russians claim. McElroy says flying above this Soviet ceiling is simply flight efficiency and has nothing to do with sticking to our political guns. The chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, John McCone, says we've suggested to the Russians that both nations stop testing nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, limiting the tests to underground. No reaction so far from Moscow. More news from Dave.
It would have been hard to believe on September 4th, 1955, that President Eisenhower would be doing what he did yesterday, because on that date he had his heart attack. Yesterday he played 36 holes of golf in a single day. He was 68 years old. Got in two full rounds traveling in his electric golf cart. That's the most he's played in any one day since 1955. And that's the way the world goes. The time, 42 minutes after.